Welcome to our Goldster podcast, where we take you behind the scenes with authors of many different writing styles. I'm Lucinda Hawksley, and today we're looking at writing about health and lifestyle. I hope you enjoy this episode. If you want to find out more, go to www.goldster.co.uk. And don't forget to subscribe to the podcast. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Goldster Conversation. I'm really pleased today to welcome Charlie Morley, who is an author and a specialist in sleep and lucid dreaming. So, Charlie, welcome to Goldster.
Hello, thank you for having me.
I'm really interested in the work that you've been doing. So tell us about your background and how you got into the world of sleep, as it were.
So from pretty young, I remember kind of telling my mum my dreams and stuff like that. And then the kind of genesis part of the story, I guess, is for my 12th birthday. So when I was 11, I asked for this thing called a Nova Dreamer, which is this electronic sleep mask that you strap to your face. And it recognizes the rapid eye movement or rapid eye movement sleep, and then flashes red lights, bright enough to permeate your eyelids, but not bright enough to wake you up. So apparently you put on this mask and then you keep dreaming about red flashing lights. And eventually you learn to associate the red flashing lights with the mask and you realize, oh, wait, that must mean I'm in a dream right now. So I remember reading this. There was this like little gadget thing that used to come with the Sunday newspapers. And it was like, you know, classic boring Sunday. And my dad was reading the newspaper and I got this gadget magazine. And I remember reading about lucid dreams and not knowing the term, but knowing that I had those dreams already.
Right.
Oh, dad, there's this thing that gives you more of those dreams I have. Can I have it? And I don't know, it was $300 or something. So I never got it. But dad confirmed that that was a true memory. So that was my kind of first intro into dreaming. And then when I was a teenager, like many kind of 15, 16 year olds, I got interested in consciousness and how the mind works. And then lucid dreaming came back again. Buddhism seemed interesting, but there were too many rules. And that's when I bought these books on lucid dreaming, which would these books that would teach you how to become conscious within your dreams and then able to direct your dreams. So anyone listening or watching who's ever had a dream where in the dream you go, oh, wow, I'm in a dream right now. My body's asleep in bed. I'm inside my mind. I'm still asleep, but fully conscious. That's a lucid dream. And also just a little kind of first takeaway for anyone who may not have had that experience or doesn't remember having the experience, because children actually have them naturally and frequently. Maybe they remember having a nightmare where in the nightmare they've woken up and gone, I've got to wake up. Because if they have, firstly, that was a lucid dream. So for many people, their first experience of lucid dreaming is nightmares. And secondly, the takeaway is, if you are ever lucky enough to become lucid in a nightmare again, don't wake up. Every time you wake yourself from a nightmare, it's like a therapy session cut short. And like any diligent therapist, if the therapy session is cut short, the therapist will do everything they can to extend the hand of friendship to the client and try and finish the therapy session, which unfortunately manifests in what we call recurring nightmares. You know, why do you never hear people talk about their recurring happy dreams? Oh, why don't I have that recurring dream of a dinner date with my favorite celebrity? Because that was, you know, there was nothing therapeutic value there. It was a happy dream. It was all integrated in the moment.
Right.
But when we have those nightmares about those things that happened to us or the fears that that may happen to us in the future, and we wake ourselves from them either intentionally or naturally because the nightmare wakes us up, we have to have the nightmare again. So nightmares are actually very good news. In almost all cases, nightmares are a therapeutic tool used by the mind to heal its internal wounds. And yet we live in a society where we use nightmares as a pejorative term.
Mm.
Now, if the internet starts going down onto Zoom connection, what do we, I'm having a bloody nightmare with my internet connection today. It's just words, but words are powerful, as you know, as a writer yourself. So yeah, we need to kind of reframe the view of nightmares, I think.
And there's been a lot of new thinking on nightmares, hasn't it, with psychotherapists. What is the thinking now? What did it used to be?
Yeah, so kind of 15 years ago when I first started teaching, the jury was out on a lot of things. But nightmares especially was, they could be a sign of re-traumatization. They're obviously indicative of a mind that is disturbed, and we want to try and get rid of them. So you would go, if you have nightmares, this still happens sometimes in GPs. You have nightmares and people want to give you tranquilizers to stop the nightmares. That is such a bad approach. We now know that nightmares, there are kind of three main things we can say about nightmares that have been scientifically validated. Number one is that a nightmare is a dream that is shouting. A nightmare is trying to gain our attention, and it's working a little bit like pain. So pain is used by the body to draw the brain's attention to a wounded part of itself. So we walk past something, we bang our elbow, pain sends a signal to the brain, says, oh, I need to rub my elbow or put a bandage on my elbow or whatever, right? So thank goodness for pain. If we didn't have it, we could bleed out every time we got a small cut. The nightmare is working a similar way. It's drawing our attention to a wounded part of the psyche. It's saying, hey, over here, you know, daddy issues, or hey, over here, fear of aging, or over here. I'm getting that. I turned 40 recently, so I'm having these nightmares about, you know, kind of forward-thinking aging and stuff like that. But when we have those nightmares, we can say, oh, this is brilliant. Thank you so much to my mind for highlighting the wounded part of my psyche, or the troubled part of my psyche that I'm not aware of. The second thing we can say for sure is that nightmares are a sign of a healing mind. So this would be for people who maybe, let's say they were in a, well, let's not use car crash. Let's use an actual example. I work with a lot of military veterans. Mm-hmm. And one of them was actually my meditation teacher. He was my Buddhist meditation teacher and also a former veteran. And he got diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder, combat zone post-traumatic stress disorder, 40 years after his service.
Wow.
And it was actually when he retired. So he was conscripted as a young man into what was called the Bush War in Zimbabwe, which was then Rhodesia. And he served a couple of years under very, very stressful conditions. But when he came out, he went back into work, and then he became a well-known Buddhist teacher and was kind of on tour the whole time. It was when he retired and there was suddenly space for the mind to go back to what had been wounded for so long that he started having these nightmares from 40 years ago. And he got diagnosed with clinical post-traumatic stress disorder 40 years after the event. And of course, this happened a lot in COVID, maybe not so extreme, but the rates of nightmares, and especially nightmares about people's childhood, went through the roof during COVID. Because for one, people weren't waking up to go to work. And for two, they were almost having a retirement experience. You know, they suddenly had more space. And I know that the age range of Goldster might be people who are retiring or coming close to retirement. So if these nightmares do come up in retirement, they are not a bad sign. It's not saying that you are being re-traumatized by what happened to you in the past. It's actually a great sign. It's saying that finally, now you've got some space to look at it. The mind is saying, okay, let's go back to this space and let's heal. And in the same way as a therapist might say to us, tell me what happened when you were a child. And we might say, oh, bloody hell, I don't want to talk about what happened. It's so long in the past. Please just let it be. Let sleeping dogs lie. But the therapist will say, unfortunately, they're lying, but they're wounded. We need mm-hmm. to wake those sleeping dogs so we can heal. So too, the nightmare is doing the same thing. And then just finally, because it's a very interesting one, the third theory on why nightmares are a good idea is called the evolutionary threat-based theory of nightmares, which is essentially that we dream about lions, tigers, and bears, or future threats, not so that they happen, but so that we're better equipped to deal with them should they happen. So for example, if you're like some of the veterans I've worked with, when they were in the military, they would often, before a big operation, have a dream that it went really badly. They'd have a nightmare that their men got wounded or killed, and they'd be freaked out, like, oh God, is it a prophecy? You know, sometimes military people are actually quite superstitious, surprisingly superstitious. And you give them this information, they say, no, what it proves is that your mind was saying, tomorrow's military operation is a really high value event for me. It's a high risk situation. And because the brain loves us, it's going to run through almost a fire drill of future possibilities. The kind of the worst that could happen, not so that it does happen, but so we're best equipped to deal with it should it. And there's an evolutionary theory from evolutionary biology that believes that's how human beings came to be top apex predator on the planet.
Oh.
Not only our ability to dream vividly, but especially to have nightmares about future events.
That's fascinating.
Cool, isn't it? So fascinating. Yeah.
So tell us about your work with the military and your work into PTSD.
Yeah, so it began about 7 or 8 years ago. I didn't really have any contact with military. I mean, my grandparents were both on both sides. My grandfathers were veterans, so I guess there was that connection. But I didn't really have any direct personal connection. But about 8 years ago, a veteran came to one of my courses that I was running. I do these lucid dreaming retreats, often at Buddhist centers or Buddhist retreat centers, where people learn these techniques. And we look at working with nightmares and how you can use lucid dreaming for spiritual practice and all this kind of stuff. And a veteran came and had a really big breakthrough. And he emailed me after the retreat saying, I integrated more of my PTSD in that 4-year retreat than I did in 4 years of therapy.
Yeah,
I remember writing back saying, yeah. And I was like, oh, mate, do you mind if I put that on my website? And he said, yeah. So it was on my website for a long time, but we weren't really friends. Then a few years later, he got back in contact to say that he had become a mindfulness teacher and a Buddhist chaplain, which sounds a bit like a vegetarian. A Buddhist chaplain in the military, which sounds a bit like a vegetarian butcher.
It really does.
But there's a lot of Buddhists in the British military, especially the Gurkhas, of course, the Nepalese, who are all Buddhist, and the growing kind of interest in Buddhism. So I had become a Buddhist chaplain and was running these retreats with veterans. And would I come and teach the same techniques? And long story short, I did. That's how I got into working with veterans. And we saw that some of these techniques are very, very powerful when working with traumatized populations. But the big insight I really had a few years later, after developing these courses just for veterans, was that trauma is trauma, whether from a literal war zone or a familial war zone. Trauma is trauma. So I started opening up the retreats to everyone, just people who are working with trauma. And in fact, in many cases, the trauma of familial abuse or familial danger was far worse than the abuse suffered in a war zone. So, you know, this idea that veterans' trauma was going to be worse than civilians' trauma was a very naive assumption for me to make. And in fact, there's no judgment to be based on trauma, right?
Yeah. And I suppose with a family, they're the people who are supposed to nurture and care for you. So perhaps it's that a different level of trauma from going to a war zone, which you know will be horrendous.
Yeah. And also there's
processes are different.
Absolutely. And the difference between single event trauma and what's often called CPTSD, complex post-traumatic stress disorder, which is multiple experiences. And yeah, if you go to a war zone, you're expecting what's happening. Of course, it's a shock. It's a complete shock. The descriptions I've had, I realize a civilian in no way can understand what goes on in the chaos of war. But you're right. If you are in a place that's supposed to be your safe haven, your house, and you're experiencing childhood sexual abuse, for example, over a prolonged period of time, that in many cases is way worse than a shorter period of combat-based trauma. But even to go beneath that, what I found is so many of the veterans come into the military because of pre-existing trauma. I remember one veteran, I'll never forget it, he said, "Who joins the army, Charlie?" And I was like, I didn't know what to say. I was like, I don't know. And he went, "Why do you think we join? We're looking for protection. He said, "I had no family. So I wanted to join the biggest, toughest family I could. So I didn't just have, you know," he said, "I had no brothers growing up. Now I've got thousands of brothers." You know, it's that sense of, wow, for so many, it's trauma that might lead them into the military service. Not all by any means, but in many cases. So it's been a fascinating journey. And some of the research we've done has been really, really powerful and really helpful. And it's an honor to work with those people.
We've got a question here. We've got several questions, but this one I'm going to come to you first. Is it possible to carry trauma one has forgotten about but knows, something that one doesn't remember happened?
Yes, absolutely. And this is a big change in the last 10 years, that not only can we hold trauma that we don't remember, but it is held somatically in the body. But secondly, trauma can be released without conscious awareness of what the trauma ever was. We can move to a point of healing and integration of past trauma without needing to know what it was, because of the way that trauma is stored in the body and the brain. That the prefrontal cortex part of the brain, the kind of the sense of I, the sense of agency, the sense of making decisions, is knocked off during traumatic experiences. This opens up a much wider question among the terrible situation in the blue light services, when often women who've suffered a traumatic sexual event might go to the police, and the police will say things like, how can't you remember what they looked like? Or why did you just stay there? Why didn't you scream? Just one workshop on the neurology of trauma would put those terrible situations to bed, because you learn that when a traumatic event occurs, the prefrontal cortex switches off. Because the psychophysical system says, look, now isn't the time for like rational thinking. Now I'm going to go into the mammalian brain and act. And it's fight, flight, freeze, or fawn, actually, is an interesting addition to this. And for many cases, in the case we're talking about, people might go into a freeze response when they're being attacked, which might look like they didn't do anything to fight off their attacker. But that's not what happened at all. their body was going into self-preservation mode. So anyway, to bring that back to the question, because of that, because the prefrontal cortex is knocked offline during a traumatic event, and with it, the assistant to the prefrontal cortex, which is the hippocampus, the memory center of the brain, we may well not only lose executive function during a traumatic event, but we may also not remember the traumatic event. However, the part of the brain that is engaged is linked to the body and the breath, which is why when people are triggered by the trauma, they may go into a panic attack. They may lose the ability to breathe efficiently. Their body may be shaking, but cognizantly, they have no idea why this is happening. So trauma is sometimes, I describe it like a black hole. You know, we can't see black holes. No one has ever seen a black hole, but we know where black holes are based on their effect on the gravity around them. They suck things into their gravity. So although we can't see a black hole, we can see its effect on things around us. And that's how we can work with trauma. You know, we see the effect of not being able to hold down a relationship, or the effect being crippling self-doubt or lack of confidence. And we can see that that didn't come from nowhere. There's something that's led to that. And even if we can't remember that, that could be indicative of a trauma from the past that we can't remember. So yes, in answer to the question, absolutely, which I think is a really good way to remove any shame that people might have around it. And secondly, it can be integrated without needing to even talk about the experience. So I mentioned the kind of therapist idea of the nightmare. In fact, talking therapy often comes out lowest on efficiency rating when looking for dealing with trauma.
Fascinating.
Breath work often comes out on top. Body-based things come out on top. Talking comes out at the bottom. And this is because the talking part of the brain is the prefrontal cortex, which was offline when the trauma happened. So often talking about trauma, asking people what happened is not the best thing, but ask them to feel into their body and look at their breath and use certain breathing techniques to regulate the nervous system while they bring the trauma into their body is very powerful. And those used to be seen as total hippie stuff 10 years ago. This was fringe. Now it's mainstream.
Fascinating. Well, it sounds, I mean, you're working with the military. It sounds like you really need to be working with the police as well. Have you ever been asked to work with the police, or have you suggested it?
Yeah, I've done some work with the Metropolitan Police last year as part of their Mental Health Month. Mm-hmm. And it was great. However, why was it only for that month? You know, I'd love to go back, but often on Mental Health Month, which was just recently, actually, you know, October, World Mental Health Month, you get this surge of interest and people have budgets to spend on mental health things. But people's mental health is an annual experience. It's not just for 1 month. I'd love to do more with the Blue Light Services.
So we've got a few questions coming in about trauma. Is being sent to boarding school at the age of 5 considered trauma? At the same time, parents divorcing and losing the home as well. Well, I'm not a therapist, but that sounds incredibly traumatic to me.
Okay, great question. So what is the definition of trauma? The definition of trauma is any experience that overwhelms our ability to cope and to integrate the stressful experience that we're going through. So never think that your trauma isn't enough. Some people might be able to go into a war zone in the gun battle and come out and not experience trauma because they were in a position where actually it didn't overwhelm their ability to cope. They were shooting, they were moving, they didn't have guilt after about what they did or they didn't do. You can go to a war zone and not experience trauma. And yet they might come home and receive bullying online, like Twitter trolling or something like that.
Yeah.
And being, you know, trolled online or social media bullying. And that will traumatize them, literally worse than the war zone they've just come from. And that's an actual experience that I've heard of from one of the ex-military. So trauma is trauma. It is anything that overwhelms our capacity to cope and integrate the stress of the stressful experience. So as far as the boarding school goes, I mean, I know someone who runs something called the Boarding School Survivors, which is a meetup group online, but it used to be in person for exactly. Yeah. Because for a child to be taken from its parents at 5 years old and sent to a boarding school, for some people, will overwhelm their capacity to cope and be a traumatic experience. For others, it would not overwhelm their capacity to cope and might be a liberating experience. So again, it's completely subjective. And one thing that traumatized one person will not traumatize the other, and so on.
I don't know if you'll be able to answer these. We've got a couple of what seem very medical questions here, but can trauma cause epilepsy, and can trauma cause asthma?
The asthma one, I've heard some research on that there is a link between respiratory conditions. It's not to do with, Yeah, look this up, because this is, I am getting out of my depth now with the medical questions. But if you look at things related to respiration, respiration is linked to the autonomic nervous system. So an autonomic nervous system that experiences great stress and is traumatized to a point where it flips from balance to sympathetic emphysis, which is like fight or flight, breathing will be affected by this. And shallow breathing will lead to respiratory conditions, which may make us more susceptible to things like asthma. And in fact, it may not even be asthma. It may actually be a respiratory system linked to the nervous system that is manifesting symptomatically as things that seem like asthma. But yeah, sleep and dream stuff, I'll answer everything.
Yes, I think medical questions, Charlie's not actually a medical doctor, as far as I'm aware.
And what we do, just so you know, with all the trauma courses with veterans and traumatized populations, I'm always with a trained psychotherapist who usually would step in for these kind of questions.
That's great to know. I was just wondering, as a teacher, what it's like if you've got a workshop with several people and you've got somebody who's struggling with PTSD and it's bringing back memories. What is that like for you to deal with? Do you feel like you're taking it on board, or are you able to deal with it yourself?
Luckily, because all of the workshops I do with traumatized populations, I always have on hand a trained psychotherapist. That's exactly when we would exchange eye contact, and they would then take the person to a breakout room. When it's online, it's literally a breakout room on Zoom. They'll go for 10 minutes and help them regulate. If it's in person, they'll kind of take them out to the space. But interesting what you said. No, the only time I've experienced any kind of what might be referred to in therapeutic terms like cross transference, where you kind of take on the pain of another, the first ever retreat I did with veterans, I came back with these really bad headaches for a couple of days afterwards, which I now, at the time, I didn't think it anything. Now I look back and I think that was definitely countertransference. But I think it was so shocking, the things I heard in that first retreat. It was so shocking. That overwhelmed my capacity to cope. So that was in some ways a slightly traumatic experience for me. But it only ever happened the first time. And I think since then it hasn't. And I think it's to do with the therapist being on hand, but also it's the attitude you go in there with. I think to go in there with an attitude, and also from like a Buddhist background, this attitude of kind of limitless compassion and the love and compassion for another being is protective. It's even kind of literally cardio protective, actually. So I think that helps. The first time I definitely felt it, but only the first time.
So we've got a question here. I've heard about night terrors. Are they different to nightmares?
Great question. Yes, they are different, and they have different symptom profile and different things to treat them. So if you've got night terrors and someone's giving you techniques to treat nightmares and even medication to treat nightmares, it won't work. So it's really important to know the difference. So what is a nightmare? And this is an interesting question. A nightmare is very subjective, right? What is a nightmare? Essentially, it's any dream scenario, dream experience that terrifies the dreamer. Mm-hmm. And that might be totally different. I mean, I love horror movies, right? So I might dream of kind of horror movie stuff, and actually it's not that scary to me.
But that would be terrifying to me. So that's a very good example.
Whereas I might be back in a dream where I'm a kid at school in an exam room, and that'll be a terrible nightmare for me because I was a dyslexic kid at school, you know, so it completely depends. But anyway, nightmare, you know, terrifying dream scenarios that happen crucially in REM dreaming sleep. So rapid eye movement, dreaming sleep. You dream in these kind of 90 to 100 minute cycles from the start of your night. But most of your dream experience is in the second half of the night. And the first half of the night is dominated by deep sleep. So you might notice that it's slightly easier to remember your dreams in the morning, and you tend to have more long and vivid dreams. The timing of this is important, because if somebody presents with something that they don't know, whether it's a nightmare or a night terror, the timing is important. So nightmares are dream experiences. So you're in the dream having a scary dream, and then you wake up, oh God, I had a terrible nightmare. And you can often remember the nightmare, and oh God, that's a really bad nightmare. Night terror is different. A night terror is more akin to a nighttime panic attack. They often happen in the first half of the night. So we're talking first 4 hours rather than last 4 hours. That can change sometimes, but almost always night terror is the first half of the night. They often won't have a nightmare, a scary scenario associated with them, but they might be like a night terror. Someone might kind of scream out in their sleep or sit up, eyes open, and then you kind of calm them down, and they don't remember it in the morning. I mean, this is one of the blessings of night terrors, that in the morning or once the person has calmed down, it's not sticky. It kind of slides right off. Oh, I'm fine. Whereas actually a nightmare, often a bad nightmare can affect you all the way up to lunchtime the next day. You know, keep going back to that nightmare. So it's kind of horses for courses. But a night terror would be more akin to a nighttime panic attack, often not associated with any nightmarish imagery. It's an effect of the body and the nervous system rather than the mind. So, for example, there are certain things we can do, like nightmare re-scripting, which is kind of a journaling exercise around nightmares. There's some art therapy things you can do around nightmares. Those won't be effective for night terrors because the night terror isn't a psychological phenomenon. It's a physical phenomenon. It's like a panic attack. So the techniques that work very well for night terrors are breathing techniques. So breath techniques before bed or in the daytime that have a calming effect on the nervous system. And then after the night terrors, there are certain breathing techniques you can do as well that will help you fall asleep. What was the actual question there? Was it the difference?
The difference between night terrors and nightmares.
Okay, yes.
And also, what is the difference between a night terror and sleep paralysis?
Another great question. So all of these are classed as parasomnias. Parasomnias are these kind of weird things that happen in sleep. So sleepwalking, sleep talking, night terrors, nightmares, kind of a parasomnia, but they're on the fringe. And sleep paralysis. Okay. So when you dream, when you're in rapid eye movement, dreaming sleep, your body is paralyzed. This is to stop you running around your bedroom. So you can have these really vivid dreams, because what is a dream? It's an internally generated hallucination that is in fact so realistic, you believe it to be real life. Think about it. You don't think your dreams are dreams. You think they're real life until the alarm goes off and you go, what a crazy dream. I was friends with Beyonce or whatever it was. So usually when you wake up in the morning, they're called REM requisites, the things that like make REM, rapid eye movement, like dreaming, the act of dreaming, muscular paralysis and sensory blockade. Like you stop taking in sounds from the outside world. You start creating these internally generated worlds. Usually when you wake up in the morning, all three of those, boom, they switch off at the same time and you wake up. But sometimes due to stress, sometimes due to genetics, sometimes due to sleep disruptions, so like jet lag and stuff like that. Some are due to meds. So if you're on, and it could be a range of medication, because most medications will affect the things that affect sleep, because sleep affects everything and everything affects sleep. So in some cases, what happens is you wake up in the morning and your brain switches back on. So sensory blockade is switched off. You stop dreaming. So you're now awake, but the paralysis mechanism is still engaged. It means you wake up in bed and you can see the bedroom and you're looking around, but you can't bloody move. And it's so scary.
Yeah.
So most people do the standard thing. They try and break it. Unfortunately, that only solidifies it more, because you're switching on the sympathetic nervous system, which is the fight or flight, which then boom, puts the body into kind of a stress mode. What's happening in that state is that basically the body is still paralyzed when you wake up. And then the brain, because it loves you and it's always trying its best, but sometimes it gets a little bit wrong, the brain goes, oh, well, if we're still paralyzed, maybe I should still be dreaming. So it starts dreaming with your eyes awake. And if you dream with your eyes awake, that's a hallucination. So for many people, not only they have the body paralysis, suddenly there's a figure in the corner of the room, or there's something pushing down on their chest. Of course, this is where we get the incubus succubus myth, mm-hmm. of a sexualized demon who is pushing down your chest. Why is this? Because the only part of your body that is not paralyzed is the respiratory system. You're still breathing even though you're paralyzed. So because of that, it feels like there's a weight on the chest. And because the brain is hallucinating, and the brain will, because it's a meaning-making machine, will create the hallucination based on the feeling, suddenly there's someone pushing down on your chest, or there's a demon on your chest, or there's a person in the side of the room. Very interesting. And this is cross-cultural. Like in Japanese culture, they call it kashinabari, and you get this weird samurai guy pushing down on your chest, because that's the kind of the mythology and culture. In I can't remember what West African country it is, but it translates as the witch who rides your back. And then we've got incubus, succubus and stuff like that. Anyway, how to get out of it. If you have sleep paralysis, try and engage the parasympathetic nervous system. Para, like parachute, slows you down, rest and relaxation. How the breath. Every time you breathe in, you mildly simulate the fight or flight sympathetic. Every time you breathe out, you simulate the rest and relax. So if you breathe out longer than you breathe in, you relax. And that's the most simple breathing technique I can teach. Breathe out for double that you breathe in. So if you're in paralysis like that, try and do this. like letting air out of a tire. That'll often break the paralysis. But before you do that, if you're up for an experiment, and it's a fascinating experiment, if you're paralyzed like that and you see scary things or something pushing down your chest, remind yourself, okay, this is just me hallucinating. And the hallucinations are based on my mind. And my mind is scared right now. So literally think happy thoughts. So think about someone you love. Think about a place you love, being like, fill your mind with love. And these apparitions, these hallucinations will reflect the state of your mind. So suddenly that demon will become an angel or a ball of light. That is such a cool experiment because, as the Buddha said, with our mind, we make the world. We see this happening. And if you look at a lot of people's religious experiences that occur, especially the Christian saints of the Middle Ages, it's often after about 4 hours of sleep, and they say that the Spirit of God pinned them down to the bed and Jesus was standing before them, taking their breath away. Now, I'm not saying that that was not a religious experience and was just sleep paralysis, but I'm saying it's very interesting how sleep paralysis can support religious experience as well as support life experience.
And so that's great tips for how to get out of that, because we've got a comment here about a nightmare. I always have nightmares when I'm woken up early on. In it, I'm horrible and no one likes me, and it wakes me and I feel awful. So what would be your technique about how to deal with a recurring nightmare like this, other than trying to stay in it?
Yeah. Okay. So if we look at a nightmare as a dream that's shouting, what is that nightmare shouting about? What is it drawing our attention to? And in this case, if it were my dream, of course, only you can interpret your own dreams. But if it were my dream, I said, what's this nightmare highlighting? It's highlighting a lack of self-worth. It's highlighting a fear that people may not like me. And however I am in my life, there's obviously some part of me that that's the greatest fear. And for many of us, it is. You know, rejection from the tribe was tantamount to death back in the day. Mm. You know, we hear in these old medieval things, they say exile or death. And I always think, oh, you got exile, that's better. No, exile was worse than death, because exile, you'll go to a foreign land and you'll be tortured to death and everyone will reject you. And, you know, exile was worse. So we're kind of hardwired that exile from the tribe is one of the worst things that can happen. So we're having this recurring nightmare that we're being exiled from the tribe. So what I would do, first of all, is write down that nightmare. Let the mind know, hey, I'm listening. No need to keep shouting about my fear of rejection. I'm going to write down this nightmare. The next thing I can say is, well, if my mind wants to highlight my fear of rejection in the daytime, what can I do to help work with that? You know, maybe I can talk to a therapist or trusted friend about my fears of rejection. Maybe I could do some self-development work that helps increase my levels of confidence, or helps me look at where my self-worth truly lies. You know, do something to let the nightmare know that you're listening. Another way to look at it is to go, okay, I'm having this nightmare, but actually I'm feeling really good in my daytime. I'm feeling really confident. Okay, well then maybe in this case, the nightmare is the second option. It's the sign of a healing mind. You know, in the same way a scab emerges from a wounded cut, from a cut, perhaps these nightmares aren't a sign that actually we're getting worse, but actually we're getting better because we're working on our self-confidence. So I would do everything I can to let the nightmare know I'm listening. Once you do this, you'll probably see a big decline in the frequency of the nightmare. And if you do something in the daytime that helps resolve the problem the nightmare is trying to highlight, two things will happen. One, the nightmare will stop. But number two, even more interesting, because this is really evidential proof, is you might have what's called a resolution dream, which is where, let's say you're having these dreams about being rejected and no one likes you and stuff like that. And then you do some self-confidence work in the daytime, or you start going to therapy, or you do something that really kind of changes your self-image. Then you might have a dream where the same setup occurs, but it's completely different. So now you're walking down the street and everyone's saying, hey, do you want to be friends? Let's be friends. And these are scientifically studied. They're called resolution dreams. And in almost all cases, a resolution dream is another message from the brain saying, we're good here. Now, this is very cool because it now means that science is moving into the realm of what used to be called dream interpretation. You know, we say our dreams, they're rubbish. There's no use to them. Well, it's like our thoughts. A lot of our thoughts, yeah, they are rubbish. They're just the mind kind of sparking off. But sometimes we have incredibly meaningful and insightful thoughts. Exactly the same with dreams. And science is now finally waking up to the fact that in many ways, dreams are offering us an insight into our mind. And that once we heal what the nightmare is highlighting, it will also say, you know, thank you, we're good here. So you'll get this resolution dream.
Great, thank you. Let's talk about your book, because this is all so interesting, but I really want to make sure that people hear about your book. It's your latest book, you've written four, I believe, is called Wake Up to Sleep.
Yes.
Five powerful practices to transform stress and trauma for peaceful sleep and mindful dreams. I mean, that's what we all need. Tell us about the book. What encouraged you to write it, and what can we all learn from it?
Yeah, so the book, as all my books, the workshop comes first. And then the books come out of the workshop. So I know that it's that the, well, yes, they are all very practical. So this is the book that came out of those workshops I was running with veterans. And it's based on these five pillars of what's called mindfulness of dream and sleep, which is my approach to sleep. The first pillar is sleep awareness. So this is like a psychoeducation piece. We sleep for a third of our lives, if we're lucky. And yet we leave the education system knowing nothing about sleep. The kind of gatekeepers to our sleep health, our GP, which is the first gatekeeper we go to, also, with full respect, often know nothing about sleep. And I say this because my stepsis has just become a doctor, just finished her training. She confirmed that in her 6 years of training, she had 2 hours on sleep, 2 hours. And yet we know that over 30% of the ailments people go to their general practitioner doctor with are directly linked to sleep. So it's not doctors' fault at all. They know nothing about sleep, but they don't. And most GPs might have been in the practice for decades, so had their 2 hours on sleep 10 years ago.
Yeah.
These, you know, revolutions in sleep happen. So the first thing is educate yourself about sleep. So become your own sleep tracker. So, you know, many people have these like Garmin wristbands and stuff like that for to track their sleep. And if those are helpful for you, keep using them. But for many people, they are unhelpful. In fact, they're so unhelpful. In the new DSM-5 medical diagnostic manual, they've included a new condition called orthosomnia, which is described as neurotic preoccupation with sleep tracker data that leads to decreases in mental health outcomes. What does that mean? Basically means, right, people are waking up in the morning. They've actually slept quite well. They feel fine. They're having their coffee in the morning. They're like, oh, I'll just check my sleep tracker thing. So they have a look at their sleep tracker and it says, oh, you only had 10 minutes of dreaming. You only had 5 minutes of deep sleep. And then they start to nocebo themselves, which is the opposite of placebo, basically start to feel really bad about themselves. And this leads to kind of mental health decreases. So really, take it with a big pinch of salt, those sleep tracker things, or even better, take it off your wrist, become your own sleep tracker. Wake up in the morning and jot down, how do I feel upon awakening? I feel quite well. I feel quite good, actually. What time did I go to bed? I went to bed at 10, but then I was reading for an hour. So, okay, sleep at 11. Did I wake up to pee? Yeah, I woke up twice to pee. That's fine, by the way, waking up to pee in the night. And then, I had a nightmare. I'm going to write that down and woke up. Yeah, a little bit of anxiety around work, actually, when I woke up. That's brilliant. That's a nocturnal journal. So waking up in the morning and basically jotting down how your sleep was. So that's the first thing we want to do. We create a baseline and we educate ourselves about sleep. There's so much about sleep that we don't know. I mean, the book is just full of the latest science and studies. But one of the coolest ones and most interesting is the idea that 1 hour extra or less of sleep can have a powerful, powerful impact on our body and mind. So many people are trying to get to this myth of the 8-hour sleep cycle, right? They've got to get 8 hours. If I don't get 8 hours, there's something wrong with me. First of all, yes, medical science says that between 7 to 9 hours per 24-hour period is for most people the optimum amount of sleep. But that's per 24-hour period. So if you're a napper, if anyone listening or watching loves to have naps, they're really good for you. As long as your nap is under an hour, and as long as your nap finishes 6 hours before your intended bedtime, because it takes about 6 hours for this certain chemical called adenosine that makes you feel tired to build up in the brain, which is why falling asleep in front of, I'm a Celebrity is the worst thing to do, because then you're falling asleep for 20 minutes. And then 2 hours later, you try and go to bed at 10 p.m. and you can't get to sleep because your sleep pressure hasn't had time to build up, right? So make sure your nap finishes 6 hours earlier, make sure it's between 20 minutes and an hour. So don't worry about getting this kind of 7 to 9 hours in a night. If you're getting like 5 hours at night, but then you can get a cheeky 1 hour nap the next day, that's 6 hours. You're almost at the threshold. Or if you are within that 7 to 9 hours, that's great anyway. However, the point I want to make is around the 1 hour thing. So every year, 1.3 billion people across 26 countries take part in a huge social experiment they have no idea they're taking part in. And this is daylight saving. You know, different countries around the world at different times, but in all of them, the day after you take an hour of sleep from people, you know, so the clocks change and we all get 1 hour less in bed, that day there is a 23% increase in heart attacks in that country. That leads to tens of thousands more death the next day when you take 1 hour sleep from people, just 1 hour. There's also a 15% increase in traffic deaths the next day because people are more likely to crash their car. And between 10 and 15, I forget, a percent increase in suicides the next day. However, flip side, later in the year or early in the year, whatever you look at it, where you give people one extra hour in bed, so everyone gets one extra hour in bed, there is a 21% decrease in heart attacks the next day. Tens of thousands fewer people die when you give them one extra hour in bed. A similar decrease in suicides and a similar decrease in traffic deaths. That's crazy. We can save tens of thousands of lives around the world by giving people one extra hour in bed. So my mission in the book is to say, look, by the end of the book, don't worry about if you're not getting 9 hours sleep, but try and be getting one extra hour sleep. If you can finish my book and you've gone from 4 hours a night to 5 hours, you've just, you know, you literally might have saved your life. If you go from 5 hours to six, you might have saved your life. So I'd say go for this one golden hour. And you might be thinking, well, if this is the science, why aren't policymakers acting on this? Very good point. And my mission is to get this into government. Like, why do we start schools so early? It's so bad for children's mental health. Yeah. Especially we know, I mean, this is a longer conversation, but children's circadian rhythms are very different. So waking a child at 7 o'clock in the morning, if they're adolescent, so from like 13 onwards, because their circadian rhythm is about 2 hours behind an adult's, it's like actually like waking them at 5 o'clock in the morning. So no wonder they're so grumpy when they wake up. So one state, it wasn't California, but it was one of the Western states in America. Based on this, they changed their school start time statewide. They started school an hour later. I can't remember what it was. Let's say they usually start at 8 a.m. They started at 9 a.m. So all these tens of thousands of children.
Great idea.
One extra hour in bed. And the main thing they saw was a big drop in traffic deaths, because in that state they can drive from like 16, right? A little bit earlier than.
Yes, of course.
And it wasn't traffic deaths in the morning because kids had had their coffee. It was traffic deaths in the afternoon when they're coming back after a day of school and they're tired because we've woken them up too early. They were all crashing their cars. You gave them an extra hour in bed. There's a big decrease in that. So many young lives were saved by giving children an extra hour in bed. So this is serious stuff.
Yeah. It really is. A few weeks ago, I interviewed this neuroscientist, Emma Byrne, and she was also talking exactly that, about how bad it is for teenagers to not get enough sleep and how their sleep patterns are completely different. But as you say, policymakers need to listen. We've got a question here. I thought you had to have a nap for 1.5 hours for the sleep cycle to be correct, or you would feel groggy. Is that totally wrong?
It's not totally wrong. So, your nap should definitely don't sleep for more than 90 minutes. The 90 minute thing, like if you could hit exactly 90 minutes to have a full complete sleep cycle, that would be really good. However, there's a risk there, which is why I say 1 hour, because then you have a buffer zone either side. If your sleep cycle is slightly different to 90 minutes, then if you sleep longer than 90, let's say you took a 2 hour nap, you would definitely, in most cases, wake up feeling more groggy, because you'd go through that 90-minute cycle. And then the brain thinks, oh, we're sleeping for so long, maybe this is our full nighttime sleep. So it will start going into deep sleep.
Right.
When you nap, you don't go into deep sleep. You go from hypnagogic to light sleep to dream, or sometimes just straight into dream. So be careful with that. If it's well-timed, you can do 90 minutes max. I always say an hour to give people this kind of buffer zone. But you can get great, like NASA, loads of the research from naps comes from NASA, actually, because, of course, you in space, you have to sleep polyphasically.
Of course, yeah.
And they found that 40 minutes seemed to be optimal for their astronauts if you're going to be having multiple naps. I'm sorry, I just realized, Lucinda, I went so off on the nap thing, I didn't mention the four other pillars. So I'm just
I was about to say to you, we need to get back to your book.
Sleep awareness is the first one. Learn about sleep, psychoeducation, keep a sleep journal. Number two, learn how to relax. So many of us are so pent up with stress that no wonder we can't get to sleep at night. We've been in kind of fight or flight the whole day. The first thing we do is learn to relax. And there's something called NSDR, non-sleep deep rest. What is that? It's essentially closing your eyes, putting your feet up and lying down for half an hour. No looking at your phone, no reading a book. If you fall asleep, you fall asleep, but you don't have to. It's not a nap. It's called hypnagogic mindfulness. So the hypnagogic state is that kind of nodding dog state. And they found that if you rest in there for about half an hour, there's so many benefits. And there's something called yoga nidra, which is from the Hindu tradition, which is like guided meditation, basically like a lying down guided meditation that you do in the half awake, half asleep state.
Wonderful.
That's really, really good for insomnia. Because if you relax in the day, you've got more relaxation in the tank to bring with you into the nighttime. The third pillar is breath work. Most of us are breathing so quickly. Again, we could do a whole thing on this, but with the average breath rate at the moment in 2020 anyway, is between 15 and 20 breaths a minute. That is quicker than we have ever been breathing in our whole lives. Our ancestors breathe about 75% slower than us. And I don't mean ancient ancestors. I mean our grandparents. The average breath rate in 1939 was 4.5 breaths a minute.
And what has brought about that change?
Very interesting. So even in the 80s, the average breath rate in the UK was 7.5 breaths a minute. So I'm an 80s baby. What the hell has happened in my lifetime to double our breath rate? Well, perhaps the same thing that has almost doubled the rates of diabetes, Alzheimer's, certain forms of cancer, obesity. I'm not saying it's caused it, but it's definitely correlated with it. Because if we look at people who do breath work to slow down their breathing, that can be used to control the symptoms of all those aforementioned things. So people think that it may be diet, it may be stress, it may be the fact that we carry these things around with us the whole time, which are incredibly stressful. I'm holding up a phone for people watching the listening to the podcast. Who knows? But we do know that breathing slower for about 20 minutes a day is really, really good for us. So if you can spend 10 or 20 minutes a day breathing not at 15 breaths a minute, but breathing at precisely 5 breaths a minute, which is just less than 75% slower than usual, it has a very calming effect on the nervous system and allows sleep to happen naturally. Because the main thing from my book is that sleep is a natural phenomena that will occur in the absence of stresses that prevent it from occurring. So all those sleep hygiene tips, they're okay. And if they work, keep using them. But to be honest, sleep hygiene is trying to change the outside world to create conditions that help us sleep. What I'm talking about is change the internal world of your biology. Because if you can reduce stress in the body, you won't need to try to sleep. Sleep will happen naturally. So if you go to my website, charliemorley.com, you'll find a page there called Wake Up to Sleep. So charliemorley.com/wakeuptosleep, which is the title of my book. And there you'll find all of these yoga nidra deep relaxation tracks for free. You'll find all of these breathing tracks, because how do you slow the breath to 5 breaths a minute? You follow a little chime. The little chime is bing, 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 but less annoying. And you follow the chime and that settles your breathing. And then the second two pillars are nightmare integration. And the fifth pillar is lucid dreaming that we spoke about before.
Brilliant. Thank you so much. We've got so many questions coming. I'm going to try and ask you as many as we possibly can. People saying you've really helped them. There's a lot of people saying that they're really helpful tips so far. Is it possible that the position one sleeps in can cause nightmares?
I thought they were going to say can cause sleep apnea, which I was going to have an answer for. I haven't seen any research that shows the position you sleep in will give you nightmares. Some nightmares, though, are actually caused not so much by any internal trauma, but things like digestion. So if you've eaten like long strain proteins right before bed, so let's say 11 p.m., you have a big steak or something, you may well have nightmarish dreams. And that's because of the positioning of the body, not allowing digestion to occur. So if you're sleeping on a certain side and your stomach's not getting the blood flow, then all the blood flow that should be going to your brain to power your dreams is going to your gut to try and work through that steak, which means you might have kind of crazy nightmarish dreams. This is where the old wives' tale about cheese gives you nightmares comes from. It's not cheese in itself, but it's long strain protein. So it could be steak as well as cheese. But no, I haven't heard that the position can affect nightmares. But what's in your body might affect the position you sleep in, and that could lead to nightmares.
And is there an optimum time to finish eating before going to sleep? How many hours?
I mean, you can be really extreme on this. Like Buddhist monks don't eat after midday.
Right.
So, you know, this thing that's very fashionable at the moment, intermittent fasting. Buddhist monks were doing this like 2,500 years ago. So you don't need to go as extreme as that. But often when we're doing the sleep retreats, we'll have an early dinner at 6 p.m. and it'll be light, like soup and salad. So that by the time we go to bed, we don't want to be hungry, but we're very light. So that the blood flow doesn't need to go to the gut to digest anything. The blood flow can be going to the brain where it needs to kind of flush through those toxins and sleep can be optimized. So I'm terrible with this. Like last night I had a cheese toastie at 11 a.m. and then 11 p.m. and went to bed because I was starving. So
you're supposed to be the poster boy for sleep, Charlie.
Exactly. And I slept fine. So I don't know. The medical stuff and the kind of practical stuff, I'd say be easy with yourself on this. But if you've got like serious insomnia, then you do want to try and do everything you can. You want to try and create optimal conditions. So yeah, if you've got serious insomnia, optimal conditions, try not to eat at least 2 hours before bed.
2 hours before bed. That's helpful. Thank you. And one other question, how do you control sleeping time without medication? I would love to sleep a little longer, but I can't. That's a great question. Thank you for that.
So this is someone who's waking up too early.
Mm.
So, I mean, it depends kind of how early they're waking up. But a lot of people find that they have a wake up after about 4 hours of sleep. This is so well documented. So people might fall asleep at, let's say, 11 p.m. and then at 3 a.m. they wake up. And this happens. Almost all people wake about 4 or 4.5 hours after they go to sleep. It's just the difference between do you remember waking up or not? Many people will kind of wake up to pee at around that time and then they remember. Other people have what's called a micro awakening, where you kind of wake up, you just check, am I safe? And you drop back to sleep again. Because, you know, we're supporting our safety here. Imagine we were all kind of monkeys sleeping in trees, right? You wouldn't sleep all the way through the night. You'd always have these micro awakenings just to check if you were safe. Mm-hmm. Some people, though, those micro awakenings, they grab hold of and then they become stressed out. And once cortisol hits the bloodstream, you can't sleep. You're now in a state of wakefulness. It is the kind of waking hormone. What I would say, though, first of all, know that waking in the night is totally normal. Based on an 8-hour sleep cycle, most people wake 4 or 5 times a night, whether you know it or not. You probably wake 4 or 5 times a night. You know, when you kind of roll over and go to the cold side of the pillow or something, you're awake. You're only awake for 5 seconds, but that's still wakefulness. So what I would say is if you wake earlier than you intend, you got two options. If it's really early, like 4 o'clock in the morning, you could choose to do a relaxation practice in bed. You could choose to kind of read your book in bed, do something that's not overly stimulating, but is relaxing. If you're feeling that there's a lot of stress about being in bed and you can't get back to sleep, get out of bed. You know, don't stay in bed feeling that you're a failure, because this kind of sense of failure like seeps into the bed. Like be in bed. If you feel that you can't sleep, okay, get out of bed. That's totally fine. I mean, if you're interested, look at the historical anthropological studies on how we used to sleep. We used to sleep in two phases. And in the middle of that phase, you can look at this in the BBC, about Grace article on this called The Way We Used to Sleep. You'd be awake for like 2 hours in the middle of the night. In fact, pubs would reopen. People would like go out for a pint in the middle of the night. They go and milk their cows. They were like awake. Then they'd go back to sleep for a second sleep. And so if it's waking in the middle of the night, it could be that you're just displaying a natural sleep cycle, and that's totally fine. If it's more that like you're waking at like, you know, 5:30, but you don't want to wake up till 7, then often allow yourself to rest in bed. When you wake up, there's something called the hypnopompic state, which is that state where you finish sleeping and dreaming. Maybe your eyes are still closed. You can hear the sounds outside. You can hear the people picking up the bins or people going to work, but your eyes are closed. That's a really good state to be in. That's called the hypnopompic state. It's a very good state for the brain. So actually just rest there, because people don't know how good that state is. They think, oh, I'm awake now, I should get out of bed. Don't wake up too quickly. Just rest in bed, because that bit where the, you know, sleep is like spring cleaning for the mind. So if you can have the bit where your mind's been fully spring cleaned, but your eyes aren't open yet, just rest there, because you might find that thoughts are very sparse. You might have great insights in that state, and it's very restful for the mind just to lie there. And then perhaps you do fall asleep after that. But if you don't, then at least you're not kind of wasting any energy. You're just resting. Kind of one of the worst ways to wake up, to be honest, is with an alarm clock. But we,
yes,
I mean, when did we sign up to that? When did we say the best way to wake up is in a state of alarm? So here's a takeaway. Please, if you do have an alarm clock, maybe use your phone. Make your alarm like a beautiful piece of music or bird song or Christian chanting or something like that. But if your alarm sounds like this, beep, 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 please switch it off, because that means the first thing that happens to your body is shock, cortisol, adrenaline, and we wonder why we're anxious all day. So that's a little big change that we can make tonight.
I've heard so many people say that their sleep improved dramatically in lockdown or when they were working from home, because they didn't have to have an early alarm because they'd lost that commuting time. Absolutely. And they could stay in bed longer. And I just wondered, are there any studies showing how much better people's health was as a result of that? Or was the anxiety cancelling that out?
So I didn't see those studies. Everything that I got asked to comment on by journalists was the increase in nightmares that people had in lockdown, which was, again, actually a good sign because people were getting more sleep and dreams happen at the end of the sleep cycle. And also, the brain was able to kind of look back into their past. So as far as kind of well-being, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But I assume if everyone's getting an extra hour, then that's going to be good for them.
Yes. But then I guess there are all the other anxieties.
Yeah, balance it out.
Yeah. Now, we've only got a couple of minutes left, sadly. It's gone so fast. And I just wanted to ask you, can you tell us anything about sleeping and aging? What happens to us as we get older? And are there things that people should be aware of? Are there practices that we should get into that perhaps we might not have been in before?
Yeah, so sleep changes. It's not necessarily that you need less sleep as you get older. In fact, because you're getting older, the body needs more time to repair. So it's not that you need less sleep. Still 7 to 9 hours is still the recommended per 24-hour period, remember. It's still the recommended amount of sleep for like all healthy adults. What you find, though, in older age is the times you spend in deep sleep and REM dreaming sleep do fluctuate and change. Napping becomes a much more viable option as we enter old age because we might find that we start waking up a little bit earlier. There was some studies showing that napping was linked to an increased rate of Alzheimer's. Please take that study with a pinch of salt. This is people who are having multiple naps. These people are having like 2 or 3 naps during the day. Yeah, if you're napping like 2 or 3 times during the day, that's because there's something that's really sapping your energy, a real fatiguing thing. I'm talking about conscious napping. So in the day, going, it's 4 p.m. and I'm going to go and give myself a half an hour lie down. And it could be that I go into a full sleep, or it could be that I just stay in this NSDR, non-sleep deep rest. But really, I would say embrace kind of periods of rest and napping during the day. Also be aware of the changes that happen in our body, especially menopause. In female bodies, menopause has a huge effect on sleep, kind of more than we can say now, but a lot of it is due to body temperature. So many of us are sleeping in bedrooms that are way too hot. One of the best improvements you can do to your sleep is to cool down your bedroom. Really, apart from the larder, if anyone has those anymore, apart from the larder, your bedroom should be the coldest room in your house, which many people don't want because they want the bedroom to be really cozy. Have your living room cozy, be in front of the telly cozy. When you go into bed, your bedroom should be so cool that if your foot is sticking out from underneath the covers, it should be so cold you want to pull it back in. You know, if you can have your foot outside the covers and it's not cold, your bedroom's probably a bit too hot. There are specific temperature gauges you can look at and stuff like that, but that's a general rule. And now, of course, menopause affects body temperature. We all know from what I've heard, hot flushes and the like. So because of these fluctuations in body temperature, sleep is going to be affected. So the first thing I say is if you're going through the menopause, know that your sleep will be affected and it's okay. One of the worst things with sleep is we have fear of sleep. We start to fear, oh God, my sleep's bad. There's something wrong with me. It's like you're going through the menopause. So yes, your sleep's going to be affected. So give yourself give yourself a break on this. And if you do need to nap and have periods of more rest during the day, then allow yourself to have that. If you need to go to bed earlier or stay in bed longer, allow yourself to do that. Acknowledge that I'm going through menopause. My sleep is going to fluctuate here. And then have a look. There's good research online you can find with the effects of body temperature and hot flushes on sleep and adjust accordingly. But I think the main thing to say is know that it's completely natural to have changes to your sleep as we age and we go through menopause. Children's sleep is completely different to adult sleep. As we age, again, our sleep changes. So be aware of that and know that sleep is something we need to constantly keep on top of. So if you are someone who 20 years ago said, I'm fine on 7 hours sleep. Well, that was 20 years ago. What are you fine on now? You know, adjust your sleep. Be constantly aware of how much sleep you need. And the way to tell this, the next day, do you need coffee to stay awake? If you do, you're probably not getting enough sleep. And that's a really, you know, that's a spiky comment to make, because most of us are so sleep deprived that we assume that having coffee to stay awake is completely normal. It's in fact not. It's a sign of huge societal sleep deprivation. So
that's a good thing to, no pun intended, take away with us. Thank you. So Charlie's book is called Wake Up to Sleep, and you've been absolutely wonderful, Charlie. I'm seeing all these comments coming in. Could have talked to you for hours. Just very, very quickly, everybody, to remind you that tomorrow is Book of the Month with Humphrey. It is Richard Bach's Jonathan Livingston Seagull.
Oh, my favourite book.
Is it?
Wow, yeah.
Long.
Brilliant. I love that book.
So look at goldstar.co.uk/book-club and find out all the other things that are coming up. And I will see you soon, but it's Humphrey with you next week. Thank you so much, Charlie. It's been wonderful. Take care, everybody, and I'll see you soon. Thank you.
It's been a pleasure.
Bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to this Goldstar podcast, where we aim to bring you great interviews to expand your world and to keep you curious. Please look us up at www.goldstar.co.uk. That's Goldstar spelt G-O-L-D-S-T-E-R. And don't forget to subscribe to the podcast.